It's Thursday, December 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Baghdad seeks NATO help with foreign forces in northern Iraq. A rights group says Islamic State took most of its weapons from Iraqi stockpiles.
No country, even the US and China, don't produce enough emissions on their own for their own action to be sufficient. So all countries have to do it, which is why you need an international agreement to ensure that everybody is acting.
VOA turns up the heat on climate change. Also ahead, a 400-year-old play gets a makeover. All that's coming up on today's International Edition. Iraq has asked NATO to pressure Turkey to withdraw its troops from northern Iraq. Ankara says its forces, numbering perhaps as many as 300, are in positions near Mosul to train and equip Peshmerga fighters who oppose the presence of Islamic State militants. The Wall Street Journal says Baghdad is close to seeking help from the UN Security Council. U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby on Tuesday urged both countries to resolve the dispute amicably.
This is an issue for Turkey and Iraq to continue to work out. We're encouraged by the fact that their defense ministers have spoken. We want to see that dialogue continue. This is an issue that both of them, we believe need to continue to discuss. It's important, and I want to restate this as a sound principle, because it's a principle that needs to be continually hit home. Iraq's a sovereign country, and we want all efforts against ISIL inside Iraq to be done with the cooperation in consultation with the Iraqi government and with their full permission. That's an important fundamental principle here, to respect the sovereignty of Iraq, and that won't change going forward. But we believe that this is best resolved between Turkey and Iraq.
RAND Corporation analyst and U.S. Army career officer Rick Brennan told VOA's Victor Beatty that it's an issue of sovereignty and says Turkey's presence was never authorized by Baghdad. Brennan also says after much planning, Iraqi security forces are shepherding the drive to recapture the Anbar provincial capital of Ramadi from Islamic State fighters.
It took them about 6 months in order to build the forces and develop a plan to go in. But right now, the Iraqi forces have essentially surrounded Ramadi. U.S. and coalition airstrikes have been hitting key targets, and they're making good progress on recapturing portions of Ramadi. The big fight has yet to come, which is a city center.
How long does this campaign last, do you think, before victory will finally be achieved?
It's too early to tell how long this will take. I think what we can expect is that it'll probably take at least two to three weeks for this to mop up. But at the end of the day, we have to view this as one step in a larger tactical battle. People are talking about the Ramadi as being a strategic city. It's not really strategic. It's tactically important, but it has strategic importance from a perspective of thinking about capturing or retaking this major city. So it's more influence than it is any type of major military strategic value.
And again, this is not just an Iraqi security matter. It also involves Shia militia.
Also includes Shia militia, but a good number of the forces are the Iraqi counterterrorism forces and Iraqi army forces, as well as many as 20,000 Sunni militia. So this is the good news. Where I worry about how this might turn out is if the Shia militias go in there heavy-handed and you start seeing large numbers of civilian casualties. But as of this point, we haven't seen that.
A U.S. defense spokesman said the liberating of Ramadi would be a blow to Islamic State claims it can hold ground and act as a government, as a caliphate, and provide a platform for future operations in the Euphrates River Valley. It's time now for us to check out what's buzzing online. International Edition's social media guru, G. Abby Lee, joins me right here in the studio. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
We're enjoying some warmer than usual days here in Washington, but It doesn't appear like that's the case in China.
Not at all. Not warm and not clear. The three-day smog alert in Beijing is still going strong, and the situation is a lot more serious than many people realize. The Wall Street Journal quoted an analysis released earlier this year, which projected the air pollution to prematurely kill more than 250,000 people in major cities throughout China. The Qatar-based Al Jazeera also tweeted, in quotation marks, "The air smells like burned coal."
Well, that's certainly not how it should smell like. Nope. How is the Chinese media portraying this?
From a slightly different angle, China's state-run Xinhua News Agency tweeted a series of photos showing photos of Beijing's iconic buildings under blue sky on a mobile phone next to the actual buildings under the smog. The tweet says, "Colorful memory against gray days amidst hashtag smog."
So what are some of the hashtags that people are using for this?
Hashtag smog is the most popular, with more than 1,300 tweets using it. The Topsy Analytics website shows hashtag airpocalypse, although very clever and catchy, is only used in less than 400 tweets in the same time frame. And Jim, some organizations and people are trying to take a lighter take on the situation. The Onion, which is a new satire organization based in America, tweeted a meme about the smog. It sent out a picture of a woman asking this question: "Who doesn't want a day off to sit inside and enjoy the fresh air?" And the WSJ China Real Time tweeted, "A smog-themed web game titled Everybody's Search for Beijing is making the rounds." Jim?
Well, thanks so much, G. Your analysis is always very clear. And the International Edition team would love to hear from you and our listeners as well. You can tweet your feedback at VOA_IE or directly to G's account at G Abby Lee. This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, here in the United States, terrorism remains a top topic. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter says the international community has to step up the fight against Islamic State before another terrorist attack like the November 13th Paris assault. He testified before the Senate Armed Forces Committee on Wednesday, Carter urging Turkey to do more to control its often porous border with Syria, and criticized Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states for being preoccupied by the conflict in Yemen. He also said it's time for Russia to focus on the right side of this fight against Islamic State. Carter said the United States has asked about 40 countries for more contributions, including special operations forces and weapons. Meanwhile, rights groups and Amnesty International says that the arms used by Islamic State were largely seized from Iraqi military stockpiles. VOA's Susan Yaki spoke about the finding with Amnesty's Advocacy Director for the Middle East and North Africa, Sunjeev Berry.
Amnesty International's latest report documents how decades of irresponsible weapons sales from Russia, China, the United States, and over two dozen other countries to Iraq have created the environment in which the armed group that calls itself Islamic State is able to acquire weapons through looting Iraqi storehouses of weapons and use those weapons to enlarge its power in the region.
How is it getting it from Iraq into where they're fighting in Syria and Iraq?
Well, one of the major ways in which the armed group Islamic State is getting the weapons is simply from deserting Iraqi soldiers who have left them behind on the battlefield as Islamic State swept across parts of Iraq in 2014. In addition, however, there are black markets, there's corruption, and the United States and other governments have done a very poor job of ensuring that the Iraqi security forces and the Iraqi government have the system set up in place to make sure that weapons that are sold to the Iraqi government don't end up in third-party hands.
What can really be done about this?
Well, the first step is to adopt a posture of presumption of denial. That means that when the U.S. or other governments are receiving requests for more weapons from the Iraqi government, the Iraqi security forces or other groups in the region that are allied with these governments and involved in the conflict, that the presumption should be on not providing any more weapons unless the recipient of the weapon can clearly show that that weapon's not going to fall in the wrong hands or be used in ways that violate human rights or international humanitarian law. So far, arms suppliers like the United States, Russia, China, and others have failed to do that. And as a consequence, we are seeing the eruptions of violence in which the armed group Islamic State is able to pick up more and more weapons as it expands its territory.
Amnesty has long spoken out about the atrocities caused by Islamic State.
Absolutely. The armed group Islamic State has been involved in crimes against humanity by systematically targeting civilian populations. You know, we've documented reports of sexual slavery, of all sorts of horrific forms of violence. And it speaks to the underlying problem in which rushed efforts to provide weapons to quote-unquote allies without concern for human rights end up creating larger problems in the longer run. And there's a significant risk that if U.S. policymakers simply repeat that approach in the Middle East today, there are going to be more whirlwinds of violence that will erupt in the days and years ahead.
Do you think the United States should put boots on the ground, so to speak, in that region?
You know, Amnesty International doesn't take a position on whether or not particular governments or parties should get involved in armed conflict. Our basic approach is to say that all parties to an armed conflict must follow the rules of international humanitarian law, including the rules of war as well as human rights law. In the armed conflict on the ground there today, there are multiple parties that have violated international humanitarian law and human rights law, and those parties should not be getting any weapons.
International negotiators, meanwhile, in Paris have released a new draft of a global deal to fight climate change. It's a draft that removes some issues of dispute but leaves others unresolved. The negotiators are trying to finalize the deal by Friday when the Paris Climate Conference, also known as COP21, is scheduled to end. The unfolding climate drama also is the subject of this week's hashtag VOA TV show. And its host, Michael Lippin, is right here in the studio. Michael, who did you have on the panel this time?
Hi, Jim. Thanks. I spoke to four environmental activists in the show about the progress that's been made so far in Paris and what has to happen next in the struggle against global warming. One of the panelists who joined via Skype from the Paris talks is Michael Jacobs. He's a British economist and a senior advisor for the New Climate Economy Project. I asked him why it's so important for the more than 180 parties at the talks to reach a deal together.
The difficult thing about climate change is that it is a global problem which only if all countries act together can we solve. No country, even the US and China, don't produce enough emissions on their own for their own action to be sufficient. So all countries have to do it, which is why you need an international agreement to ensure that everybody is acting. But of course it's really important then that the two largest countries are committed to doing so. So what we have in Paris is now a coming together of all countries to take action. And already, even before Paris, we arrived at the conference itself, 183 countries had published their emissions reduction plans and targets for the future, and that has indicated that countries do want to act on climate change. They all understand now how serious this is going to be for our economies and for our lives, and that is why there is tremendous goodwill here to try and reach an agreement.
Now, I also spoke to Kelly Levin of the World Resources Institute via Skype from Boston. She attended the first part of the conference, and I asked her what kind of support developing nations will need to fulfill their climate commitments.
So I think that developed countries have acknowledged that they do need to take the lead, that there's also a push to get increasing numbers of new actors involved, both the private sector as well as new countries involved in giving support. And the support needs to be on all different levels in terms of finances, capacity building. And when we think about capacity building for tracking progress in MRV, it is also about collecting data at the national level, being able to do trainings in terms of methodologies of how to quantify impacts of policies. And it's across a whole number of different suites of activities that will make implementation a reality as well as one that can actually be tracked and reported back to the international community.
Well, Michael, who were some of the other guests on this week's hashtag VOA program?
Well, I'll tell you, we had two other panelists in the show who are specialists in green energy projects. One is Dan Gilbo, who works for the Washington, D.C. Department of Energy and Environment and who is in our studio. And also Mark Ginsburg of the U.S. Green Building Council, who spoke via Skype from Paris. Now, the U.S. Green Building Council runs a rating system for buildings around the world called LEED, which stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. Here's what Ginsburg said about the global progress in adopting the LEED system.
Well, I think there's a great spirit of wanting to follow the precept of if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And so LEED is a system that helps cities and companies and organizations know how they are progressing in their energy consumption, how they compare with other building owners and operators. And so it gives them a real tool to help them know how to implement energy efficiency in their buildings.
And back to Dan here in the studio, how common is LEED certification in Washington?
It's very common in D.C. I think one of the most exciting things about D.C. right now is that LEED and other ratings programs have really just been embraced by the private building sector. So really, you just don't see Class A buildings being built that aren't LEED certified because there's such strong demand. And we're not talking lower level certification. It's among the higher levels of certification that really is being built right now. So it's very, very popular.
Well, for more on the show, you can actually watch it on our Facebook page. Just search for hashtag VOA. Jim?
Michael Lippin, host of hashtag VOA, which you may also see each week on our website. That would be voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
William Shakespeare's tragedy Macbeth gets a new treatment from Australian director Justin Kurzel. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the film stars Oscar winner Marion Cotillard and Oscar nominee Michael Fassbender as the doomed Scottish king and his ambitious wife.
Director Justin Kurzel's Macbeth opens with the title character and his wife standing next to the grave of their only child. Their grief then transitions into a blood-soaked battle scene, after which a victorious Macbeth meets three witches who tell him that he shall be king of Scotland.
Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Clumps.
Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Cawdor.
All hail Macbeth, that shall be king hereafter.
There's only one problem. Scotland has a king, Duncan, whom Lady Macbeth, played by Marion Cotillard, persuades her reluctant husband to murder when Duncan visits their castle.
I have given suck, and know how tender it is to love the babe that milks me. I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from his boneless gums and dashed the brains out had I so sworn, as you have done to this.
Michael Fassbender, known for his roles in Shame, Inglourious Basterds, and the X-Men series, says taking on the role of the doomed Scot was something that required a lot from him.
There's just so many endless versions you can do and various sort of interpretations of it. It's just, which is very encouraging and also kind of depressing, because I would walk away thinking, God, you know, there was another thousand ways that could have been done. But just really becoming comfortable with it.
Cotillard, who won an Oscar for her portrayal of Edith Piaf in La Vie en Rose, says she was reluctant to take the part until she talked to director Justin Kurzel.
The way he talked about the fact that he wanted to show that they were in love with each other, and they wanted, and he wanted to show, yeah, the humanity of those two people really got me, and gave me the desire to be part of it.
Fassbender says Cotillard brought a new vision to the role and was a joy to work with.
She's a really very sort of unique actor, and the fact that she sort of really works very much in the moment-to-moment sort of elements of a scene. She doesn't come forcing something on a scene. She allows it to sort of organically sort of take place, and that's pretty rare.
The film was shot on location on Scotland's Isle of Skye, and the weather and the landscape play a large role in the story. Kurzel's vision also has the characters working in spare surroundings, not grand castles, but empty, dark, cold landscapes. Battle scenes take place on muddy, wet hillsides, which also add to the feeling of desperation and isolation. Macbeth also stars David Thewlis as Duncan, Paddy Considine as Banquo, and Elizabeth Debicki as the ill-fated Lady Macduff. Macbeth is rated R for strong violence and brief sexuality. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com, and we're also on Twitter. Follow us at @VOA_IE. Our engineer is Dan Crafton. Our director is Tracy Carter. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We thank you so much for joining us and invite you to come back and spend some time with us again tomorrow. Have a great day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Barack Obama recently addressed the American people following the terrorist attack in San Bernardino, California, which left 14 people dead and some 21 injured. "This was an act of terrorism," said President Obama, "designed to kill innocent people." The United States has been at war with terrorism since Al-Qaeda killed nearly 3,000 Americans on 9/11. But over the years, the terrorist threat has evolved into a new phase. Terrorists have turned to less complicated acts of violence, like the mass shootings that have occurred all over the world in recent weeks. "The United States has a plan to overcome this evolving threat," said President Obama.
"We will destroy ISIL and any other organization that tries to harm us. Our success won't depend on tough talk or abandoning our values or giving in to fear. That's what groups like ISIL are hoping for. Instead, we will prevail by being strong and smart, resilient and relentless, and by drawing upon every aspect of American power."
Specifically, the U.S. military will continue to hunt down terrorist plotters in any country where it is necessary. In Iraq and Syria, airstrikes are taking out ISIL leaders, heavy weapons, oil tankers, and infrastructure. The U.S. continues to train and equip tens of thousands of Iraqi and Syrian forces fighting ISIL on the ground in order to take away their safe havens. U.S. intelligence is working to disrupt ISIL's plots, cut off their financing, and prevent them from recruiting fighters. With American leadership, the international community has begun to establish a timeline to pursue ceasefires and a political resolution to the Syrian war. This strategy to destroy ISIL is supported by U.S. military commanders and counterterrorism experts, together with 65 countries that have joined an American-led coalition. "We will succeed in this mission," said President Obama. "Americans have always met challenges, whether war or depression, natural disasters or terrorist attacks, by coming together around our common ideals as one nation, as one people. So long as we stay true to that tradition, I have no doubt America will prevail."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.